on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 on Facebook or at grendelscoffee.com.
This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach and welcome. My guest today is short story writer Phil Klei. Born in White Plains, New York in 1983, his debut collection, Redeployment, has just been published by Penguin. Welcome to Between the Covers, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you had the opportunity after the military to study under Colm McCann.
I did, yeah.
What was that like? He's a wonderful writer.
Beautiful writer, and also just a wonderful human being. I mean, just a great, great guy. You know, very, like, no nonsense. If something's not working, he will tell you directly. And really pushes his students hard, but is very, very invested in their work. You know, and also a very close eye to the language. I mean, he was one of the people who talked to me very early on about, like, the sort of language of acronyms, and pushing me to kind of explore how that functions in military culture and language.
Yeah, you have a story that is almost entirely acronymic.
Yes. A story which is I think, you know, the challenge running that was to have an acronym in every sentence and knowing that most readers would not know what the acronyms means. Most vet readers are not going to know every acronym in there because, you know, the military has all these little subcultures. But to still have an intelligible story that is, you know, expressive and meaningful, that deals with the way in which that language works, you know, because there's, you know, there's a rhythm and a beauty and a way in which that, you know, that functions into the way the character thinks.
When you were deployed to Iraq, how did the reality there differ from your perception beforehand?
You know, the first time we were there for about a month, and there was a suicide truck bombing outside our main gate, and you know, Marines were bringing in the wounded from that, and you have all these, you know, civilians that the truck bomber had blown himself up in the midst of a bunch of families going to mosque, and seeing the kind of injuries that bombs do to human bodies. Is especially on that scale, with just, you know, dozens and dozens of people coming through. It's not something that you're really prepared for, and even at the time, you sort of, like, you kind of shelve off your emotional reaction to what's happening, and then you know you try and do something productive, hopefully, and then you think about it later.
Last year in the Harper Index, there were statistics. 8% of Americans were involved in the military in World War II, 5% in Vietnam, 0.5% now.
Right.
And you speak to this in your collection, too, the lack of a shared sacrifice.
It's such a small portion of the population. It's all volunteer, right? And in addition, you know, we as a nation, I don't think there's, at least certainly in terms of how the wars were sold, right, not a sense that this was going to involve a collective sacrifice, right? And so there's a huge disconnect, and I think it's different from other generations in that with an all-volunteer military, it's much easier for the population to be apathetic or to lose interest, and that causes a lot of issues.
And is there a way to address it?
Well, I mean, I think it's very important for us collectively as citizens to think about these, to to talk about them, to imagine what those experiences are like from inside the heads of other people. It's part of why I wrote the book. And I think that more and more veterans are starting to talk. And also there, you know, you have civilian voices that are getting in the conversation, which I think is really important. You know, there's some great books written by, you know, Ben Fountain, Roxana Robinson, Lee Carpenter. Karen Russell has a great short story called The New Veterans, about sort of precisely, you know, the connection between a civilian and a veteran and how they can engage. And actually, you know, Colm has done the same. And I think that those conversations are very important, and they need to keep going, because we collectively go to war. You know, the Marine, the soldier doesn't issue themselves orders. And we're, as citizens, responsible for making sure that our, you know, that we keep tabs on what we're doing.
Has your sense of what patriotism means changed over the years?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that sort of the importance for me of a real, deeply felt civic engagement with the major kind of moral questions of our policy, I think that has become much more meaningful to me, this sort of honest and rigorous effort to think about our moral relationship to what our country is doing, good or bad, has become much more important to me than sort of whether somebody, you know, whether somebody's a liberal or conservative or, you know, whatever their, you know, affiliation. It's the degree to which they think that this is something that I have a personal responsibility to, and what is my role in that? How should I act?
One sacrifice that soldiers make that isn't often credited is that of their moral qualms. They've been taught since childhood not to kill, and yet even their spiritual advisors might tell them it's all right in a way.
Right. I think, you know, in war, and one of the things that I tried to talk about in the book is you know, you have all these people in different jobs, but they're put in these very intense, constrained circumstances, and then they have to make decisions. They have to make decisions with huge moral consequences sometimes. And then they have to live with them afterwards. Sometimes the way that we talk about veterans, you know, you have these kind of two extremes of either, like, you know, he's a hero, superhero killer, Navy SEAL guy, or, you know, like a passively traumatized shell of a man, right, who's, you know, gone through the horror of war. And it's much more complicated than that. People have gone over and they've done a very hard job, and they've made a lot of decisions within that.
Would you give us a reading now from your story, Prayer in the Furnace?
Absolutely.
And for those of you who may have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today, Phil Clive, reading from his short story collection, Redeployment.
So this is a Marine who, infantryman, has come to the chaplain, is the narrator of this story. And he's worried that his unit has sort of lost restraint in this incredibly violent city, and they have a very kind of aggressive leadership. So, and he's coming for spiritual advice, but also, you know, maybe to ask for help. So I'll just start off. "The city's an evil thing," he said. He shrugged. "I do evil things. There's evil things all around me." "Like what?" I said. "What evil things?" "Acosta's gone," he said. "Acosta ain't Acosta no more. He's wild." He shook his head. "How can you say this place ain't evil? Have you been out there?" He gave me a cruel smile. "No, you haven't." "I've been outside the wire," I said. "My vehicle was IED'd once, but I'm not in the infantry." Rodriguez shrugged. "If you were, you'd know." I chose my words carefully. "This is a life you chose. Nobody forces you into the military, and certainly nobody forces you into the Marine Infantry. What did you think you would find here? Rodriguez didn't seem to have heard me. When Acosta says, I'm going to do this one thing, and Acosta's got respect, De Toro don't, but me, I got respect. I can slow Acosta down. He laughed. I used to think you could help me, he said. His face turned vicious, but you're a priest. What can you do? You got to keep your hands clean. I tensed up. It was as though he had struck me. No one's hands are clean except Christ's, I said, and I don't know what any of us can do except pray he gives us the strength to do what we must. He smiled at that. I wasn't sure I believed the words I was saying to him, or if there were any words I'd believe in. What do words matter in Ramadi? I don't think about God no more, he said. I think about Fuji. It's like grace, I said, God's grace, letting you to hold on to Fujita. Rodriguez sighed. Look at my hands, he said. He put them out in front of me, calloused palms facing up, and then he turned them down and stretched out his fingers. I look calm, right? Yes. I don't sleep no more, he said. Hardly ever. But see my hands? Look at me. Look at my hands. It's like I'm calm. The conversation stayed with me well after Rodriguez had gone. You're a priest, he'd said. What can you do? I didn't know. As a young priest, I'd had a father scream at me once. I was working in a hospital. He'd just lost his son. I thought my clerical collar gave me the right to speak. So right after the doctors called time of death, I went and assured him his infant son was in paradise. Stupid. And of all people, I should have known better. At age 14, I lost my mother to a rare form of cancer, similar to what struck that father's son. And every empty condolence I received after my mother's death only deepened my angry teenage grief. But platitudes are most appealing when they're the least appropriate. This father had watched his healthy child waste away to nothing. It must have been maddening. The months of random emergency room visits, the brief rallies and the inevitable relapses, the inexorable course of the disease. The final night, his wife collapsed on the hospital floor in terror and grief, shrieking, "My baby," over and over. Doctors repeatedly asked the father to authorize last-ditch attempts to keep his child breathing. Naturally, he did. So they proceeded to stab his son with needles, perform emergency surgery, torture his child in front of him, and at his request, in a hopeless effort to continue a tiny, doomed life for a few minutes more. At the end, they were left with a very small and terribly battered corpse. And then I came along, after the chemotherapy, after the bankrupting bills and the deterioration of his and his wife's careers, after months of hoping and despair, after every possible medical violation had denied his child grace, even in death, and I dared suggest some good has come of it. It was unbearable. It was disgusting. It was vile. I didn't think hope of the life to come would provide comfort for Rodriguez either. So many young people don't really believe in heaven, not in a serious way. If God is real, there must be some consolation on earth as well, some grace, some evidence of mercy. That father despaired, but at least he was looking at life head on, stripped of the illusion that faith or prayer or goodness or decency or the divine order of the cosmos would allow the cup to pass. It's a prerequisite, in my thinking, to any serious consideration of religion. What, like St. Augustine, can we say after Rome has been sacked? Except Augustine's answer, the city of God, is a comfort designed for the aftermath of a tragedy. Rodriguez, that Lance Corporal, Charlie Company, the whole battalion, they were a different matter. How do you spiritually minister to men who are still being assaulted?
Thanks for reading that, Phil.
Thank you.
You mentioned several important books in your acknowledgments, a great number, but among them was J. Glenn Gray's The Warriors, Reflections on Men in Battle. Also, Jonathan Shea, Achilles in Vietnam, mm-hmm. Combat Trauma and the Undoing of Character, and his book, Odysseus in America. These are really great, great works. What did you learn from them?
I mean, plenty of things. I think, you know, Shea, of course, goes through the range of psychological reactions to combat, to all the associated problems that, that people can encounter overseas, and it was very important for me to think about that very seriously if I was going to try to attempt in any way to write honestly about what people are going through. And of course, you know, the Achilles in Vietnam is about the undoing of character, right? And you know, for that story that I just read from, you know, Rodriguez is talking about a guy in his unit who he'd looked up to, who it seems like is kind of deteriorating under this intense, violent atmosphere, a guy who's on his second deployment after having had a very rough first deployment, and starts doing really bad things. And you know, I think it's very easy, to talk about terrible things that happen in wartime, and sort of abstractly. But if you're going to talk about it honestly, you need to really think about why those things happen in very bad circumstances, and the pressures that it puts on men and women, and the, you know, the decisions that they make in relation to it. And then J. Glenn Gray is just—I mean, that's a wonderful book, *The Warriors*. He's a philosopher who served in World War II, and then just kind of has a very just not a romantic view of combat or military units. Not a negative view, but just a very kind of straight on. This is how military units function. This is, you know, different types of soldiers that you have. These are the sort of philosophical implications of some of these things. So that was certainly in my mind when I was reading that book, the thing that I liked about it the most was just the very unromanticized, let's, you know, deal with this experience and the types of men that are involved and what they're doing in as rigorous a way as possible.
There's a line you wrote: suffering has always had its own mystique. What exactly is that mystique?
It's very hard. If somebody's been through an incredibly difficult experience, right? And war is certainly, for many people, one of those experiences. How do you then connect with that person, right? If you haven't been through that. How do you, Shay in Achilles in Vietnam talks about communalizing trauma, right? And sort of that an important stage is when the veteran who has suffered PTSD can tell his story to somebody who wasn't there and see that person sort of is empathetically engaged with it and sort of trust that person could then go off and talk about that experience in a way that was sort of respectful and honest. And I think that there's a way in which sort of the extremity of could be war, could be other experiences as well, makes people feel isolated and alone, and that, you know, there's a way in which sometimes when we talk about war, we actually kind of privilege that. You know, I talk at some point about the notion, like, if you weren't there, you can't know, and you don't have, and so you, if you can't know, then you don't really have a role in the conversation. And it sounds like you're saying, you know, only the veteran can speak the truth, and that you're propping them up, but actually what you're doing is you're sort of isolating them. And you're also absolving yourself of the responsibility to imagine what that experience is like, and you're absolving the veteran of the need to actually explain. And I think that, you know, going forward, as I talked earlier about the sort of how few people are in the military, boy, we need more of that communication to happen.
Whose fictional accounts of war have gained the most traction with you?
Iliad's pretty good. That's a good place to start. Isaac Babel, I love.
Red Cavalry.
Red Cavalry's incredible. Tolstoy's amazing battle scenes. I love The Good Soldier Švek. It's a Czech novel. Catch-22, of course. It's not fiction, but Grant's memoirs are amazing. The Red Badge of Courage. There's plenty of amazing war literature. I read probably some of my favorite stuff. Anthony Powell's A Dance to the Music of Time.
I love that.
It's amazing. A 12 novel series. Absolutely incredible. And novels, I think the 7 through 9 are set during World War II. And I think it's one of the best depictions of war ever, and in part because it's part of this huge narrative arc, and it talks about, you know, soldiers but also civilians, and it gets at all these, you know, all this complexity. There's some stuff by Sakaguchi Ando, who's a Japanese writer who is not much translated, but I studied with James Dorsey, who translated a bunch of him. And he's written a bunch of essays, Japanese during World War II, and also sort of these kind of weird short stories that are kind of allegorically related. I think, you know, in the aftermath of that for Japan, you had a kind of reckoning with what had happened among some writers that led to some really interesting and strange stuff.
We now have joystick computer-assisted drone pilots who kill from a great distance, thousands of miles. We have artillery crews shooting from miles away, and you have a story about one such gun crew. I wonder if you'd read from that story for us, if you would.
Sure.
And so, for those of you who may have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today, Phil Clive, reading from 10 Clicks South.
All right, so there's an artillery unit who has just fired for the first time at an enemy target, right? But about 6 miles away. So they, you know, they fire off the rounds, but they never see what happens. They're just told that they hit the target, and they're one of several guns who was firing. And they're trying to figure out, you know, whether they killed people, how many people they killed, what their relationship to it is. "Okay, Sergeant. We were on target," says Jewett. "But the other guns, their rounds could have hit first. Maybe everybody was already dead." "I can see that. The shrapnel thudding into shattered corpses, the force of it jerking the limbs this way and that." "Look," says Bolander, "even if the rounds hit first, it doesn't mean everybody was dead, necessarily. Maybe some insurgent had shrapnel in his chest, right? And he's like..." Bolander sticks out his tongue and clutches his chest dramatically, as if he's dying in an old black and white movie. "Then a round comes down. Boom. He was dying already, but the cause of death would be blown the hell up, not shrapnel to the chest." "Yeah, sure," says Jewett, "I guess. But I don't feel like I killed anybody. I think I'd know if I killed somebody." "Nah," says Sergeant Dietz, "you wouldn't know. Not until you'd seen the bodies." The table quiets for a second. Sergeant Dietz shrugs. "It's better this way." "Doesn't it feel weird to you," says Jewett, "after our first real mission to just be eating lunch?" Sergeant Dietz scowls at him, then takes a big bite of his Salisbury steak and grins. "Gotta eat," he says, with a mouthful of food. "It feels good," Forstadt says. "We just killed some bad guys." Sanchez gives a quick nod. "It is good." "I don't think I killed anybody," says Jewett. "Technically, I'm the one that pulled the lanyard," says Forstadt. "I fired the thing. You just loaded." "Like I couldn't pull a lanyard," says Jewett. "Yeah, but you didn't," says Forstadt. "Drop it," says Sergeant Dietz. "It's a crew serve weapon. It takes a crew." "If we used a howitzer to kill somebody back in the States," I say, "I wonder what crime they'd charge us with." "Murder," says Sergeant Dietz. "What are you, an idiot?" "Yeah, murder, sure," I say, "but for each of us? In what degree? I mean, me and Bolander and Jewett loaded, right? If I loaded an M16 and handed it to Vorstadt and he shot somebody, I wouldn't say I'd killed anyone." "It's a crew served weapon," says Sergeant Dietz. "Crew, served, weapon, it's different." "And I loaded, but we got the ammo from the ASP, I say. "Shouldn't they be responsible too, the ASP Marines?" "Yeah," says Jewett. "Why not the ASP? "Why not the factory workers who made the ammo," says Sergeant Dietz, "or the taxpayers who paid for it? You know why not? Because that's retarded." "The lieutenant gave the order," I say. "He'd get it in court, right?" "Oh, you believe that? You think officers would take the hit?" Vorstadt laughs. "How long you been in the military?" Sergeant Dietz thumps his fist on the table. "Listen to me. We're gun 6. We're responsible for that gun. We just killed some bad guys with our gun, all of us. And that's a good day's work. I still don't feel like I killed anybody, Sergeant, says Jewett. Sergeant Dietz lets out a long breath. It's quiet for a second, then he shakes his head and starts laughing. Yeah, well, all of us except you, he says.
Thanks for reading that, Phil.
Thank you.
From Between the Covers, this is Jim Schumach, my guest today, short story writer Phil Cly. His debut work, Redeployment, has just been published by Penguin. Hey, I'm so glad you dropped by this morning, Phil. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sex Workers film series. June 7th at 7 p.m. will show Meet the Falkins. Louise and Martine Falkins are identical twins. For over 50 years, they were working as prostitutes. They freed themselves from the control of their pimps, ran their own brothel, and set up the first informal trade union for prostitutes. Meet the Falkins is a portrait of these women. Again, that's June 7th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor Tryon Life Community Farms Bloom Festival on Sunday, June 8th from 2 until 10 p.m. Bloom Festival is filled with live music, activities, local organic food, and performances at the TLC Farm next to the Tryon Creek State Forest, featuring live music by Soul Nectar, Selkies and Cedars, The Dirty Dandelions, Serotone, DJ Carola Mariachi, and many others. There'll be special entertainment by Clown Snot Bombs, performing in the circus act Spaghetti Western. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Again, that's Sunday, June 8th from 2 until 10 p.m. at the Tryon Life Community Farm.
Good morning. This is the June edition of Black Book Talk. Today's broadcast will be a one-year anniversary rebroadcast of our interview with Dr. Maya Angelou. We join her now. We hope you enjoyed it the first time, but if we missed it, we are sure you'll enjoy it now. Thank you.
Blue.
Join my feet, cause I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman. That's me. Men themselves have wondered what they see in me. They try so much, but they can't touch my inner mystery. And when I try to show them, they say they still can't see. And I say, it's in the arch of my back, the sun of my smile, the ride of my breasts, the grace of my style. And now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me walking, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palm of my hand, the need for my care. Cause I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman. That's you. You and me.
Good morning and welcome to the June edition of Black Book Talk. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman, and I'm here with
Patricia Welch, the library lady,
and Obie Hill, Miriam H. Books.
This month, we are so delighted to have with us Dr. Maya Angelou, who's written a new book called Mom and Me and Mom. Welcome. Dr. Angelou will start off by reading to us.
Thank you. Frequently, I have been asked how I got to be this way. How did I, born black in a white